It's only been a few weeks since all eyes were on the premier event in golf. I said the word golf, that's right. The master's degree. Now, I have to tell you, I didn't think much about the master's degree until we moved here. I've never been much of a golfer. Golfing was always something to me that took money, and I didn't have money to go play golf. But with that said, with the master's degree taking place only about 200 miles from here, I found myself a bit taken by, as probably many of the viewers and those in the gallery, with this young phenom. Now, if you happen to be a golfer, you know that Jordan Spieth is this young guy who won the Masters this year, about how well he was playing. Now, part of the appeal, at least for golf for me, is yes, they hit great shots, and it reminds me of how well I play golf on the Wii game, at least at home. But in a case like this, as I was watching, I guess I was struck by the fact that this kid, at about, you know, what, 21, could golf so well and wind up, what, 18 strokes, if I remember right, under par. It was downright amazing. And I think I found myself contrasting the golf game that he was playing with someone else on the course that not too long ago we were saying the exact same things about. And you know that other person. He goes by the name of Tiger Woods. It was not that many years ago that Tiger Woods was at the University of Stanford, and he was a golf phenom par excellence in terms of what he did at the amateur level. And then, if you remember right, in 1996, he went pro, and it was only 1 year later, he was barely 20, just over 20, about the same age, when he went to the Masters tournament here, and he won as well, 12 strokes under par, and we stood aghast at anyone who could golf that well. And anyone who knows Woods knows also how prolific his wins have been since that time. In fact, I just went to find out. He has won 12 majors and 85 tournaments total. You know, it was Woods who was seemingly invincible. In fact, I found him of such encouragement at one point that I actually wrote a letter to myself, and this may seem a bit odd. I was in graduate school, and I happened to have had a meeting with the individual who was the director of the graduate program, and it was the middle of my first semester, and when I went and sat in this meeting, he hit me with, which is not maybe interesting enough for you, but he said, "I really have questions about whether you should be here, whether you're smart enough to be here." And I listened to this meeting, and I had such high respect for this guy. I left the meeting, and I went and wrote myself a letter. This may sound a bit odd, but the letter drew on a lot of what I'd seen Tiger Woods do in terms of his achievement. And I had gone and read an interview just prior to that where he talked about how you can't listen to other people if you're going to succeed. And indeed, as we look at Tiger Woods' life, he was seemingly invincible until November 28th, 2009. Remember what this date involves? You probably don't. The National Enquirer ran a story about Tiger Woods' infidelity. At first with one female, then with two, then with five. Remember what number we got to? We got to 12. 12 females. And he began to see his world crumble around him, to implode. You know, to many of us who followed Woods' career, this was a shock. This guy was as close to perfection as you get. How could this occur to someone who I'd put on such a high pedestal? Even as an athletic, someone in athletics who seemingly had it all. He had the perfect life. It was really his televised apology that took place 45 days later that gave a big part of the reason why. And I'm going to quote a section here about what he said in this televised apology. He said, quote, "I knew my actions were wrong, but I convinced myself that normal rules did not apply. I never thought about who I was hurting. I thought I would get away with whatever I wanted to. I felt that I had worked hard my entire life, and I deserved to enjoy all the temptations around me." Boy, if that doesn't fit with that first message. "I felt I was entitled. Thanks to money and fame, I didn't have to go far to find them." Woods goes on to acknowledge his failures, failures that really grew, as he talks about in this speech and also elsewhere, from an ego that happened to be out of check. In fact, he actually addresses it as a problem at one point with pride. It really wasn't too long ago that I gave a message on humility. And in giving the message on humility, I found myself kind of contrasting it with the other end of the spectrum. And the other end of the spectrum was pride. I really found myself spending a lot of time going through what is pride and how it's the opposite of humility. And indeed, as I thought, there's enough here for a good sermon or a message of its own. And so with that, I developed one. I've then entitled this message, "An End Time Warning Against Pride." An End Time Warning Against Pride. Now, the end time you'll see here shortly as to why I've referenced the end time warning. It'll be in part because of where we go and look at some scriptures along these lines. But I thought that the topic fit well, particularly because of the events that we're seeing take place around us, Tiger Woods included. So in a case like this, we might ask ourselves, so what is pride and what does God say about it? Those are just two general questions we should address. Pride defined. Let's go to dictionary.com. Let's go to a basic definition. Nothing fancy here, but if we're going to define terms, we need to do so clearly. Pride is defined as a high opinion of one's importance. A high opinion of one's importance, merit, or superiority. A high opinion of one's importance, merit, or superiority. If you go look through the King James Version about the way in which pride is used, it's used multiple different ways. It oftentimes comes in the form of, by translation, conceit. And pride routinely manifests itself in terms of action as the distancing ourselves or of oneself from others. It also can involve reservation, where you withdraw yourself from others because you think of yourself as superior, and or contempt for someone else. And so I found myself going through Scripture looking for these tendencies. You know, when we look at what God says about it, even a preliminary way, there are several Scriptures that come to mind, and I'm going to ask you to just go to a few with me, one of which I'll hold. Proverbs 11, verse 2. Proverbs 11, verse 2. Proverbs 11, verse 2. I'm only going to read the first part of the verse because you know this. God oftentimes, well, let's read the whole verse. God oftentimes provides a nice counter to what he offers on the first part in terms of an understanding that's provided here. Proverbs 11, verse 2 reads this way. When pride comes, then comes shame. Boy, if that doesn't sound like Tiger Woods. But with the humble is wisdom. So we read that in Proverbs 11, verse 2. Let's go to another scripture. Let's keep going forward in our Bibles. Mark 7. Mark 7. Now, we're going to go all the way forward to the Gospels. The second book, Matthew, Mark, in the New Testament. Forgive me there. Mark 7. We're going to read an account here about the Pharisees and how they thought of themselves. And the first part of this chapter of Mark 7 talks about how the Pharisees thought so highly of themselves. They really were a prideful group. And if you transition forward, or if you move forward to verses 21 through 23, in fact, let's go backwards just a hair here. In 17, we get some context. And when he had entered a house, that being Christ, from the crowd, his disciples asked him concerning the parable. So they're asking a very basic question about the parable that preceded this. And if you want to go back, you can even see here that part of the parable that was addressed deals with the keeping of commandments. And in fact, it's noted there. To verse 20 is where I'm headed. And he said, "What comes out of a man, that defiles a man." So what's in us? Jeremiah 17, 9, "The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked." What comes out of a man defiles a man. Human beings we're corrupt to the core. And then in 21, we begin to read what things come out of a man. "For from within, out of the heart of men proceed," and we get a listing, "evil thoughts, adulteries, fornications, murders," they grow in plural, "thefts, covetousness, wickedness, deceit, an evil eye, blasphemy," and then we get this word, "pride." Pride, remember, that is the notion of superiority or our self-importance. Foolishness, and then the tail end that Christ offers here in verse 23, all these evil things come from within and defile a man. So we see pride grouped with all of these things. I've got one more place for us to go, 1 John 2. Now, I'm leading us to the back of the God's Word so that we can wind up at a place. So there's actually a method to my madness here. 1 John 2, verses 15 and 16. 1 John 2, and this is an epistle of John, 1 John 2, and we're going to read again, looking for how God uses the word pride, because we see pride show up so many different places in His Word. 1 John 2, verse 15, do not love the world or the things in the world. If anyone loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. You know, that provides, and I have a scriptural reference here. You may have the same thing. Mine says Romans 12, 2. And if you remember, Romans 12, 1 and 2 talks about don't be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind. Remember by background what that says here? But 15 tells us that if you're in love with this world, then you're not. There's an either or here. You're either in love with God, or you're in love with the things of this world. And if you're enamored, taken with the things of this world, then you're not in love with what God offers. So then in 16 it offers this, for all that is in the world, so what's in the world? The lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and the pride of life is not of the Father, but is of the world. So we have these categories, and the pride of life is one of them. Now note what happens if we become taken with these things. Verse 17, and the world is passing away, and the lust of it. But he who does the will of God abides, lives with God forever. So we see this all played out. It's not then such a surprise that we see this appear in these different letters of John, or that we see them, which is where I'm headed, in the book of Jude. Now, Jude is only one chapter long, but I'm going to ask us to go there because the book of Jude really highlights the events at the end of this age. It really, the book itself, it's, however many odd verses, because again, it's only one chapter, really contrasts God's truth for only 25 chapters. It contrasts God's truth with the apostasy at the end of this age. Now, I use the word apostasy like we all use this word all the time. Apostasy, if we've gone and looked at it, refers to the abandoning of one's religion or religious principles. The abandoning of one's religion or religious principles. Boy, if we're not a nation abandoning our religious principles, I don't know what we are. We are trying to come up with ways to abandon our religious principles. Even the message that we heard earlier today by Dr. Steve Holliday, where he quoted Hillary Clinton's words that we need to change our cultural orientation. It's time, I'm paraphrasing, it's time that we mature and get a much more realistic sense of what our cultural and our religious beliefs are. That's what she said. That's striking words. Jude then underscores in this book about how important it is that we hold dearly to the truth that we've been given. And he uses key words to do this. If you remember in this one simple book, he uses words like contend and battle and fight. Now that doesn't sound kind of like the powder puff Christians of today. Doesn't to me. That sounds like someone who really is deeply invested and active in terms of one's own Christianity. And that's what Jude does through this single letter. Because what he contends is that the reader, you, me, the reader must fight for the calling that they've been given. That we're not to deal with it passively, but that we need to understand and contend and fight for it. Because in a case like this, it's not just something with a minimal reward. You've been given the opportunity for eternal life and leadership in God's kingdom. This is not something you or I can take lightly. And that's what Jude is all about here. So with that said, the message that comes from Jude's letter touches on this. And it's going to touch on the topic of pride as we see here. So we're in the book of Jude. I'm going to start reading in verse 1 so we get a little bit of background. And I'm really heading for one verse, because nestled right in the middle of this single book are some examples of pride that we can spend some time exploring then today. Jude, a servant of Jesus Christ, verse 1, and brother of James. Who's this letter to? To those who are called, sanctified by God the Father, and preserved in Jesus Christ. He at this time is talking to, if I take a step away from the text, he's talking to the diaspora. He's talking to the church of God that's spread abroad. And he's trying to encourage them wherever they might be, saying, you've been given this incredible truth. Don't minimize this truth. Dropping to verse 4, he continues. No, let's go 3. Beloved, while I was very diligent to write to you concerning our common salvation, I found it necessary to write to you exhorting you to contend earnestly for the faith which was once delivered for all delivered to the saints. So what he's saying again is he's saying, don't take this lightly. I'm here to encourage you. I'm trying to think of a synonym for exhortation that underscores the emotion he tries to convey here. These are not just objective words floating out of his mouth. He's got a whole lot of heart he's investing here. And he's saying, don't take lightly what you and I have been given. Verse 4, for certain men have crept in unnoticed, who long ago were marked out for this condemnation, ungodly men who turn the grace of our God into licentiousness, lawlessness, and deny the only Lord God and our Lord Jesus Christ. So by background, what's he again saying? Is he saying that these men were marked at one point, those who happened to occur previously, they were marked as, well, I knew that they would creep in. And what it's going to do is test you. It's going to test your faith when you're here. And you can't shake. You can't be shaken by this. You can't falter. You've been given something precious. You know, if I think back in days gone by, you know, I wasn't here at the time, but I know within the Atlanta church area that when you would have holy days, 1,200 people, 1,600 people, I may even be short there. I know that up in Michigan, when the Browns were up there, we would have church and we would have any number of places, and you'd have 500, 600, 700 people. No surprise. I mean, in the mid-80s, in the mid to late 70s, when we were in Wichita, Kansas alone, we had 650 people. And I was talking when I was at the conference with Ed Dowd and with his wife, Rayanne. They only have about 30 to 35 people there now. And if you kind of unpack the stories, part of the stories that you unpack is that people allowed others to take their crown. Now, there's opportunity for them to again be restored. But this is, in a case like this, wouldn't you think that the numbers would only stay steady or increase? But that's not what happened. We've actually seen this kind of play out. What we see here is a dangerous mindset that has crept in. And we, by Jude, are warned, well, by Jesus Christ, are warned, don't buy into it. Don't take it lightly. You know, then as we see in verse 17, I'll just make reference here, what we read in this passage is we begin to recognize that the book itself is dedicated, focused on end time events. Verse 17 alone says the following, but you, beloved, remember the words which were spoken before by the apostles of our Lord Jesus Christ, how they told you that there would be mockers in the last time. If you were to insert some scriptures here, boy, this fits perfectly with Matthew 24, verse 24, Mark 13, Luke 21. This all fits right there of those events that play out. So backtracking then to verse 8, Judas inspired then to cite examples of those who act in their own pride, out of their own superiority. And we see in verse 6 one example, and the angels who did not keep their proper domain but left their own habitation, He has reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day. So I just hit on one of these examples, but what we recognize here is that those who happen to be in selfishness, in pride, acting out, are penalized. Just as we talked about consequences in the first message, there's a consequence here. Verse 7 reads this way, "In Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, in a similar manner to these, having given themselves over to sexual immorality and gone after strange flesh, are set forth as an example, suffering the vengeance of eternal fire. Likewise also these dreamers defile flesh." These dreamers. I got really interested in what is meant by this word, "these dreamers." And so I went and looked up several different commentaries. The notion of dreamer references, and I'll just use one to paraphrase the Help Word Study Bible. It references those who dream dreams which exalt the flesh over the things of God. They exalt their own personal agenda, their own personal belief set over the things of God. That's what it references there in terms of dreamers. "These dreamers defile the flesh, reject authority, and speak evil of dignitaries." And then going on from there, and we see another example, "Yet Michael, the archangel, in contending with the devil," now Michael being a good example, "when he disputed about the body of Moses, dared not bring against him a reviling accusation, but said, 'The Lord rebuke you.' But these speak evil of whatever they do not know, and whatever they know naturally, like brute beasts, in these things they corrupt themselves. Their high-browed, high attitude of themselves brings corruption." Because what it does is it begins to cloud what is right and what is good and what is of God. "Woe to them," verse 11, "for they have gone the way of Cain." Well, this is interesting. He offers all these examples, and then he says, "they have gone the way of Cain, have run greedily in error of Balaam for profit, and have perished in the rebellion of Korah." Boy, then this, I found this intriguing, because I go back and read this, and I begin to read about false teachers, and I begin to think about the high-mindedness, the vanity they have about themselves. And I find these examples, and I thought, you know, that's a message in itself. So what I think is wise for us to do, in that Jude has taken the time to look at these examples, is to take a good part of the rest of this message to go and look at what happened with each of these examples. Each person, Cain, Balaam, and Korah, in order to understand more clearly what it was in terms of pride that was so negative. What was so bad about this? So let's deal with this in terms of a cautionary tale. Let's go first to the example of Cain, Genesis 4. Now, this is an older example, and we're about as familiar with this as we can be. I was talking this morning even with Mr. John Davies, and we got to talking about how whenever he was in Imperial Schools, I went to Imperial Schools for a year, but he spent most of, if not all, his years in Imperial Schools, and he talked about how they spent so much time dealing with the Old Testament. He said, "Man, I had those stories down." And I, understandably so, in fact, I was trying to think about this. Most of my upbringing in terms of my teaching as a young person really focused a lot on these stories. So this story is about as familiar you get as we might get, but indeed it's one that Jude references in this context of understanding those who happen to be high-minded, proud. Genesis 4 verse 1, "Now Adam knew Eve his wife," they had sexual relations, "and she conceived and bore Cain and said, 'I have gotten a man from the Lord.' Then she bore again, this time his brother Abel. Now Abel was a keeper of the sheep, but Cain was a tiller of the ground." Now there's no difference in terms of profession, it's just that they did different things. "And in the process of time it came to pass that Cain brought an offering of the fruit of the ground to the Lord, and Abel also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of the fat." So we get a comparison here. Now we can go into the Hebrew and begin to understand that they've really provided very different offerings in terms of the attitude and the mindset that they gave. Without taking more than enough time here, what we find is that as Abel went to pull an offering, and again, many of us are aware, he went and took the finest. He went and said, "What is my best? Because that goes to God." And Cain, in contrast, said, well, I've got to give something, so I'm grabbing what I need to. So I fulfill the obligation of the offering, but it may or may not be my best. And certainly my attitude is not lending itself to showing my best. And so that's what we see up through 4. That tail end of verse 4 reads this way, and the Lord respected Abel and his offering. He got it. He understood it. But he did not respect Cain and his offering. And how does Cain react? And Cain was very angry, and his countenance fell. He was forlorn. So the Lord said to Cain, why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? And if you do well, will you not be accepted? If you were to do the right thing, wouldn't I be accepting of that? You know, I'm going to provide a contrasting example, and it's one that I even told my wife this morning. One of the most basic things that I do in class, and it happens to be one that about 10 years ago, I came across. I had a student in class, and this was longer ago than that, but I modified the assignment. One of the things that I require in class is for students who come to class, they run a series of exercises. Generally, every class we do 2 to 3 exercises. And these exercises, every time they're done, the student is responsible for answering a series of questions. Because generally, based upon the learning research, I know how this works. You're to prepare, there's no surprise for us, is it? You're to prepare in advance for class, so you should read in advance. That's a question they answer for me. They then come to class and participate in the discussion and or exercises. They have to answer a class. They have to detail what it is that they have conducted in class. Then they have to review the content after class. They have to answer an item for me on that. And the last question is, tell me your performance on this chapter. And I give them a Likert scale, 1 to 5. And with a Likert scale, that said, I tell them, if you've done everything, you give yourself a 5. Okay, this sounds real basic. These are the easiest 100 points you'll ever get in a class. And I make that point clear. And every semester, out of 35 kids, I usually get about 3 to 5 that don't even come close to following instructions. So this semester, not a surprise, same deal. I had that segment who handed me a wad of papers stapled somewhere at the top with these questions for each chapter partially filled out. And then they get their grade. They usually do okay. Now, with grades being electronic and everything put online, as soon as I put a grade in and push enter, it comes up on their smartphone. So you can probably guess what I get just a few minutes later. Ding on their end. I get an email shooting back this way. And you already can anticipate what the email says. Dr. Ost, why in the world did I not get all these points? I was so good in all your classes. That is the nature of the email. So I had this comment again. And my comment to a guy more recently, leaving him name unmentioned, was, I handed you the papers. What more do you want from me? And my email back was, you didn't fill out any of the paperwork. The instructions say, I need you to answer the 5 questions for each class, and you'll get all the points. I only assign you points when you fill this out. And his response back is, well, why can't you see past all of that and just give me a grade? Oh, my. So you can probably guess what we do. We play tag team by email back and forth. Now, here's the only reason why I offer that. Just as we heard in the first message, there's a consequence for everything. In fact, as I said to my family this morning, I said, I've got this thing kicking around in my head, and I've got this guy I'm answering emails with, and he knows that he didn't do it right, and I'm heading the way of mercy. I know where this is going, that if he actually fills it out, he can get partial credit. But that said, the thing that I oftentimes laugh at is it's as though there are no consequences for your actions, that I can only do half as much, and you give me all the credit. That's really what he's after. In fact, that word entitlement that Tiger Woods, boy, I don't know if we use this word all the time right now. I think I get so aggravated by a student who will say, but I'm entitled to this. Well, I don't really care what you're entitled to. You have to do X and you get Y. That's how this works. The reality is, if you're on the job and you only do partial, you lose your job or your client. That's how life works. So that said, we see in here, even as I've kind of gone through this example, is God says, in essence, that much when he says, if you do well, verse 7, will you not be accepted? If you do the things that are required, won't it be acceptable? And if you do not well, sin lies at the door, and its desire is for you, but you should rule over it. Boy, that's the first message we heard today. Now Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass when they were in the field, you know what's about to happen, that Cain rose against Abel, his brother, and killed him. Took a life right there. Killed him. Then the Lord said to Cain, boy, this is an interesting series of comments, isn't it? Where is Abel, your brother? And he said, this being Cain, I do not know. Am I my brother's keeper? And he said, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood cries out to me from the ground. So now, here's the consequences. You are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, here's consequence, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. It won't come up rich and fertile and green. A fugitive and a vagabond, you shall be on the earth. You know, Cain's pride drove him down a very dark road, a road of self-justification, a road of hostility and anger to his brother. And on this path, he dismissed the basic truth that God had provided him, that if he simply obeyed, he would reap blessings. You know, in a case like this, that path was a very crooked path. And it was one that didn't end in peace. It ended in pain. Verse 13, and Cain said to the Lord, here's his reaction. My punishment is greater than I can bear. You know, how might we know if Cain eventually actually righted this wrong? You can read further here, because he says, it's just what we get out of this is, it's unbearable. I can't carry this. This is too much. As we go forward here and we read about the fugitive and a vagabond on earth and him feeling overwhelmed, God actually says in 13, therefore, whoever kills you, okay, whoever kills you, vengeance will be mine. I'll take sevenfold on that person. And the Lord set a mark on Cain, lest anyone finding him should kill him. You know, we might again think through, what was the fruit of Cain's actions? Well, Matthew 7, verses 15 through 17 says that we know any tree, any plant by its fruit. What was the fruit? How did this work? Well, we really don't have any idea that Cain's life turned around. In fact, I hate to tell you, it doesn't really look like it did. Because it wasn't too much later that all those generations that existed, what did God have to do prior to Noah? He said, this is a mess. I got to start over. And the only way I can start over is by drowning everyone. So God had Noah build an ark. He put his family in it, and he started over. You know, as we see from this, an entire generation had to be destroyed because of pride, as it started here in Genesis 4. So we have to at least ask ourselves, at times, do we think like Cain? At times, do we act like Cain? Now, I'm not saying killing someone. But remember how Christ says that if you hate a brother, you've committed murder in the New Testament? We have to ask what our motivation is. Is our motivation one of humility, or is it one of pride? I'll only address one verse here, and I'll quote it. Proverbs 29:1 reads this way: he who is often reproved and hardens his neck, because that's what happened with Cain, will suddenly be destroyed, and that without remedy. We've talked about Cain. Let's go to a second example that Jude references. He's inspired to write. Let's go to the example of Balaam. Numbers 22. Now I got to find the book of Numbers, and you're patient if you're already there. Numbers 22. Now this is an interesting story because this deals with the Israelites, and the Israelites are headed for the promised land. And they're going a direction, and we're going to deal with a couple of characters in the form of Balaam and Balak. And we'll see this kind of manifest itself on the early part. So I'm in Numbers 22, and I'm going to begin reading in verse 1, and I'm going to go to about verse 6, and we'll talk about what's here. Then the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab, on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho. Now Balak, the son of Zippor, saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. What he'd done is he'd heard that God had been with the Israelites, and that God had empowered the Israelites to destroy the Amorites. Remember that? And he's heading them to the promised land. And so in a case like this, Balak hears this and he says, I got to do something about this. I got problems. And Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because there were many. And Moab was sick with dread because of the children of Israel. So Moab said to the elders of Midian, now this company will lick up all that is around us as an ox, that being the Israelites, as an ox licks up the grass of the field. And Balak, the son of Zippor, was king of the Moabites at the time. So a case like this, Balak knows what's going on. And if it helps here, Balak happened to be king of Moab. He was well aware that the Israelites had to go by or near his land, close enough so that he could see them, and he feared that he would be wiped out. And so, headed for Canaan, he said, I got to do something about this. I got to think through this. Now, the interesting part here is, by storyline, the Israelites wouldn't have bothered them at all. But for whatever reason, Balak was convinced of this. So he's going to go find someone, and Balaam is the one that he goes to find. Verse 5, then he sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor at Pethor, which is near the river in the land of the sons of his people, to call him, saying, look, a people has come from Egypt. See, they cover the face of the earth and are settling next to me. They're close to me. So let's deal with who Balak is. Balaam. Balaam happened to be a pagan priest. He was a prophet of Mesopotamia. Now, if it deals with names, because I think names are oftentimes telling in terms of the character of the people. Interestingly enough, Balaam means destroyer of people. That's quite interesting. At least I thought that. And as long as we're doing name definitions, Balak means empty. So now we have Balaam and Balak going through this conversation. In a case like this, Balak has asked for Balaam. He said, send me this prophet. And by storyline here, he's going to say, I need you to curse the Israelites because I got a problem going. And the only way I know how to deal with this is to have a prophet curse the Israelites. Verse 6, therefore, please come at once. Curse this people for me, for they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you cursed is cursed. You know, by background, here, we don't necessarily know. There may have been some track record that he had some prophetic abilities in terms of a knowledge, but the reality is he's probably heavy on the flattery here too. He said, whatever you do, I'm convinced that you can curse them and then I'll be good. And so that's what we kind of get out of this. Balak wanted Balaam to curse Israel as the Israelites then camped in the plain of Moab. And so to do so, what we wind up seeing is that Balak chooses to offer Balaam money. I got it. I know how I'll get you here. I'll get you here by offering you a big purse. Now, interestingly enough, Balaam knows about the Israelites. In fact, as background here, as you read this section, Balaam actually says to God, there's this interaction that goes on where Balaam, in talking with God, Balaam says, you can't go and curse them. In fact, every time you open your mouth, you're just going to offer a blessing. That's going to what's going to wind up happening. And he said, so I'm telling you first, this is what he told him first, don't go to the Moabites. But if you go, the thing that you want to be paid for so you get that big purse, he said, I'm not going to allow to happen. What comes out of your mouth is actually going to be a blessing and not a curse. That's how the storyline reads if you go here. And we see that as we go down. In fact, you can drop to verse 18. Then Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. In other words, God has told me only so much that I can do. I can't do anything more. God was specific in terms of saying, don't go and do this. And the thought here would be that Balak indeed wouldn't do this. But Malik begins to think through this, and he knows that there's a big pile of money for him in this. And he starts to come up with a way, in his own superiority, his own high-mindedness, about a way that he can keep God happy, and he can also deal with what Balak has commanded. What we then find him doing is, if you drop, and we went to 18, if you go back and read in verse 12, God said to Balaam, "You shall not go with them, you shall not curse the people, for they are blessed." What we wind up doing, if you read, and this is a longer account, it goes all the way to Numbers 31, but the bulk of the story happens here in this chapter. What we find is that Balaam chooses to figure out a way to do this. And how does he do this? He knows that the Israelites' weakness is twofold. That they have problems with idolatry, and they have problems with intermingling with those who happen to be of foreign nations. So he actually makes a recommendation that, well, I can't curse them, but I can certainly have these two vices introduced. He thinks he gets around it, doesn't he? He thinks he's smarter than God. And then we wind up over in Numbers 31. Numbers 31, and we find out that despite the fact he thought there was more than one way to skin a cat, doesn't work that way. No, that's kind of a tough phrase, isn't it? More than one way to skin a cat. More than one way to skin a dead animal. There we go. Verse 8. And they killed the kings of Midian, Numbers 31, verse 8, with the rest of those who were killed, namely Evi, Rechem, Zur, Hur, and Reba, the five kings of Midian. Balaam, there he is, the son of Beor, they also killed with the sword. So what we wind up finding here is that indeed they wind up giving their life because sin. In a case like this with Balak and Balaam, we see Balaam wind up taking his life too, or having his life taken as well. You know, it's helpful for us again to ask ourselves, how often do we think too highly of ourselves? To the extent where we think, well, I know God says this, but I'm sure I can worm around it that way. Or I'm sure he doesn't really mean it that way. The reality is, when we read an account like this, it's really pride kicking in. And the sad part is the consequence is failure. I say failure, it's sin oftentimes, which is what we heard in the first message. We've gone through the example of Cain and Balaam and their problem with pride. Let's go to one other example, and it's one that we are familiar as well. Number 16, we're going to go backwards. Number 16, we're going to go to Korah, because that's the third one that June mentions. Korah is in Numbers 16:1. Again, familiar story. Jude offers it. Again, the Israelites are moving. And Korah becomes convinced that he and 270-odd people should rebel. That's really what we see here. Numbers 16, verse 1 reads this way. Now Korah, the son of Izhar, the son of Kohath, the son of Levi, with Dathan and Abiram, the son of Eliab, and On, the son of Peleth, sons of Reuben, took men. And they rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 elders. I was wrong with numbers. 250 elders of the congregation, representatives of the congregation, men of renown. Now, let's think just briefly about this, about who we have at play. We have Korah going after Moses. We know several things. We know that he's a man of renown, because we see that reference. If it helps, he's also a cousin of Moses. And we know that by going back to Exodus 6, verse 18 through 21. We know that this is a family issue in part. I don't know if you ever have family issues. This is a family issue. And we know that he holds a prominent position because we can see that in a number of different places. Numbers 16:2 and Numbers 16:9 both reference that. So what we see here is that for whatever reason, Korah pridefully says, "Moses! I don't, and 250 don't like the way you're doing things." And we see that play out in verse 3 on. They gathered together against Moses and Aaron and said to them, "You take too much upon yourselves, for all the congregation is holy. Every one of them, we're all equally holy. For all the congregation is holy, every one of them, and the Lord is among them. Why then do you exalt yourselves above the congregation of the Lord? Why are you important? So when Moses heard it, how does he react? He doesn't necessarily stop. This is, I think, an interesting reaction. He doesn't say, you know, you have something there. On the latter end of 4, he says, he fell on his face. Why would he fall on his face? Because he knew how God hates pride. He falls on his face, and he spoke, verse 5, to Korah and all his company, saying, tomorrow morning the Lord will show who is his, that being the Lord's, who is holy, and will cause him to come near to him. That one whom he chooses, he will cause to come near to him. Do this, take censers, Korah, and all your company. Put fire in them and put incense in them before the Lord tomorrow. And it shall be that the man whom the Lord chooses shall be the holy one. So it's either you or me, because that's what you're asking me to say here. You take too much upon yourselves, you sons of Levi. Then Moses said to Korah, hear now, you sons of Levi. Is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the work of the tabernacle of the Lord, and to stand before the congregation to serve them, and that he has brought you near to himself, you and all the brethren, the sons of Levi with you, and are you seeking the priesthood also? So he's really asking the extent to which he wants. And I'm going to keep reading here because the storyline works well, continuing. Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. And what is Aaron? That you murmur against him. And Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, the sons of Eliab. But they said, we will not come. Is it a small thing that you have brought us up out of the land flowing with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, that you should keep acting like a prince over us? Okay, so I need to stop momentarily because I need to track here. What at this point we're seeing play out is Korah talking. And Korah is saying, if you remember by background, you can't be all that and plus some, because the reality is we're not in the promised land. That's really what he was frustrated by, and that's what he was saying. Now, he does something here. He actually twists this. He says, in essence, God has not taken us to the promised land, but the reason why God has not taken us is really God's problem, and it's not ours. Now, the part of the story that he seemingly neglected was that in a case like this, it really was a contempt for God's instruction, because the Israelites were hard-hearted people. The reason why God hadn't taken them right to the land of milk and honey is because of them, not because of God, and not because of Moses. And so if we're clear by storyline here, Korah is actually in part offering some truth, but the reality is he had missed a whole section here, that the reason why God had not led them to the promised land is because indeed it had been the hardness of their hearts. It had been their own pride. Verse 15, then Moses was very angry and said to the Lord, do not respect their offering. I have not taken one donkey from them. I haven't taken anything from them, nor have I hurt one of them. And Moses said to Korah, tomorrow you and all your company be present before the Lord, you and they as well as Aaron. So what we see then happen as we go further down, and I won't read necessarily anything further, as we see played out here, Korah indeed attacks, and what we see God do is God does what? He says the next morning, this is how I'm going to deal with it. I'm just going to open up the ground, and we're going to get rid of 251 guys. And then we'll start, and we'll keep moving the right direction, and we'll deal with the pride that way. You know, in Korah's heart, really, the pride that he experienced was manifest in him opposing Moses. Korah wanted the government altered, but he didn't want it altered for right. He wanted it equitable so that he was a top dog, as much of a top dog as Moses. He was, Tiger Woods' word, entitled. He felt entitled. When we go back to Jude, what we see are the result of Cain, Balaam, and Korah's prideful actions. I'm going to take you all the way back to the book of Jude, and we're going to just read what happens after the verse we just looked at, because then we get to sense the consequence of these three prideful actions. their examples. Verse 12 this way. Let's drop to verse 14. Now Enoch the seventh from Adam prophesied about these men, saying, "Behold, the Lord comes with 10,000 of his saints." Now that's referencing 1 Corinthians 15. "To execute judgment on all, to convict all who are ungodly among them of all their ungodly deeds." Remember how we started with the fact that pride is an ungodly deed? And we went to multiple examples here about pride being an ungodly deed. Here's the judgment that has to happen for those who happen to be prideful, which they have committed in an ungodly way, and of all the harsh things which ungodly sinners have spoken against him. What we then see here is indeed those who happen to be examples here set in the middle of the book of Jude are ones who operated off a mode of pride. That was their compass. And inevitably, their lives will be taken if that mindset remains. You know, we might ask ourselves, even as we go through this section, so what do we take from this? And we're going to have some points that overlap with the first message, but I offer the following about pride. First of all, we have to shun anything that smells of pride. Proverbs 8, verse 13, the very first part reads this way, I'll cite it. "The fear of the Lord is to hate evil, pride, and arrogance, and the evil way." God commands us, instructs us, don't have anything to do with pride. The consequence is death. Second point, we have to respect God. First, we must shun pride. Second, we have to respect God. Isaiah 66:2 reads this way, "Has not my hand made all things? And so they came into being, declares the Lord. These are the ones I look on with favor, those who are humble and contrite in spirit and tremble at my word." Remember Moses' reaction to Korah? His reaction is falling face down because he knows the consequence of being prideful with God. We have to have a healthy respect for God. And that healthy respect, as we already noted here, fits with what we heard in that first message and connects nicely with point three. Point three is this: we must draw close to and submit to God. We must draw close to. Now, drawing close and submission are very close. In fact, even as I was going through this message, I thought to myself, the term submission or surrendering to God all work well here. Here's where I'm going to ask you to go to James 4. And James, we oftentimes read this section. We read, and it's a memory verse, is James 4, 7. But I'm going to read here because, again, another scripture that references pride shows up here. And it contrasts humility with pride. James 4, verse 6, "But he gives," God gives, "more grace. Therefore, he says, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. Therefore," here's what we need to do, "surrender, submit to God. Resist the devil." This fits closely. Remember the notion of resistance? That is exactly what Jude was after. He says, you got to fight. You have to contend. You have to battle. Because Satan walks around like a roaring lion, what? Seeking who he may devour. He's not passive about anything. He's going at you and me from every direction. So we have to fight. Submit to God, resist the devil, and he will flee from you. Draw near to God, and he will draw near to you. Cleanse your hands, you sinners, and purify your hearts, you double-minded. You know, as we see all of this manifest, as we understand that we have to shun what's wrong and adhere to what God has and do so daily, then we become more like God. We become malleable and we become more like something God can use now and in the future. When we read God's Word and we understand that this happens through prayer, meditation, fasting, and we fix our eyes on Jesus Christ, Hebrews 3:1, we avoid the consequences of pride that we read take place with, in a case like this, the three individuals we see in the middle of Jude. We wind up humbly to God, going a right path, and reaping the blessings of humility. You know, it was not too long ago that the 79th Masters Tournament took place not too far from here. And I don't know about you, but I was watching television, watching this young guy, Jordan Spieth, 21 years old, shoot 18 under par. And as much as I was taken with this, I think I was also taken with the fact that one of my heroes, sports heroes, Tiger Woods, was on camera only a few times and marginal at best in terms of the tournament. And I understand they're the best golfers in the world, but this is a guy that was supposed to break Jack Nicklaus's record. He was getting contrasted there with Jordan Spieth. Why no green jacket for Tiger, I thought? Well, it wasn't too long ago that he let his pride get in the way. In fact, it was only this week, if you happen to see, that even his relationship with Lindsey Vonn kind of went kaput. Is that a surprise? Nah, it's not a surprise at all. God says it this way, Proverbs 16:18, pride goes before destruction, a haughty spirit before a fall. It was February 19th, 2010, or at least 45 days later, that he offered these words. Tiger Woods said, "I was wrong. I was foolish. I don't get to play by different rules. The same boundaries that apply to everyone apply to me. I brought this shame on myself. I hurt my wife, my kids, my mother, my wife's family, my friends, my foundation, and kids all around the world who admired me." He admitted his pride. While Tiger has since golfed, he's in no way risen to that same stature he had before. Indeed, what we read in Proverbs 16:18 has come to pass. Brethren, God hates pride. Let's not make pride our downfall. Let's make sure that our attitude, our character, our legacy be one of humility, true humility, that is defined by our relationship with God.